Chapter 10 Inquisition Lex Talionis. Lately, I have been contemplating revenge. Not that I am hoping to enact it, of course, but I found myself mulling over this most profound and visceral of instincts. A friend of mine recently told me how he had been sold a second-hand car with faulty fuel injectors. A mechanic told him that it was impossible that its previous owner could not have been aware of the problem, yet when he sought a refund, he was denied. Sitting by a log fire in a local pub, my friend outlined his evil scheme. He would take a rowing boat after sunset down the river that flows past the back garden of this salesman's house. He would creep onto the premises and push an incendiary device through the cat flap. Then he would flee into the night, presumably cackling with malevolent glee. I have always taken the view that revenge is an entirely natural instinct, out of which we are generally socialized. Every parent knows that young children value fairness above all things, and commonly will seek out retribution if they sense injustice. But as my friend's plan shows, it's an instinct that never quite goes away. Not that he seriously intended to go through with it, of course, but there was something about the level of detail that made it clear that he had been indulging in this fantasy for some time. Private fantasies, even of the most diabolical kind, can have a cathartic effect. The ancient Greek tragedians understood this in their grisly portrayal of violent reckonings, usually described in the most lurid of terms by a messenger. We may not approve of Medea when she sends a poisoned dress to her husband's new lover, but when we are told of how the victim's flesh was torn from her bones as she attempted to disrobe, we understand Medea's satisfaction. The literal meaning of catharsis is a purging. We wash away our worst impulses by seeing them enacted on the stage. Our immersion in this theatrical fantasy is only ever temporary. And, after the curtain falls and our rationality is restored, we are able to consider the possibility that Medea may have slightly overreacted. This is why revenge stories can be so successful. The plot of Quentin Tarantino's two Kill Bill films, 2003 and 2004, can be summarized in a few sentences. A man attempts to murder his former lover with the help of some accomplices. He fails. She recovers. And then kills each perpetrator one by one, saving him for last. The films work brilliantly because, in addition to Tarantino's flamboyant set pieces, he does not seek to overcomplicate the motives. The same can be said for Miyazaki's I Spit on Your Grave, 1978, or Neil Jordan's The Brave One, 2007. It's why Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, 1982, is the best of the series. The unending stream of violence in John Wick, 2014, is so enjoyable because we want our hero to avenge those who murdered his dog. Wick's actions are utterly unjustifiable from start to finish, and all the better for it. This is cinema as pure cathartic gratification. Revenge stories remind us why we don't act on impulse, and it helps that they are often inherently absurd. Titus Andronicus, if produced well, is one of the funniest of Shakespeare's plays. Our hero takes his revenge on the men who raped his daughter by slitting their throats, mincing up their flesh, and feeding them to their mother in the form of a pie while dressed up in a chef's outfit. There is a moment when Titus asks his daughter to carry his dismembered hand between the teeth of her tongueless mouth, while he in turn takes hold of his son's decapitated head in his one remaining hand. I refuse to believe that Elizabethan audiences did not laugh out loud at the audacity of this image. To seek revenge is to surrender to our basest passions, and that's why it makes us so ridiculous. That said, C.S. Lewis is right to remind us that revenge is a perversion of something good. Revenge, he writes, wants the evil of the bad man to be to him what it is to everyone else. This is why the avenger not only wants the guilty party to suffer, but to suffer at his hands, and to know it, and to know why. The lex talionis of the Old Testament, which seeks an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, is superseded in the Gospels by Jesus Christ and his turning of cheeks. An intuition for justice is not inherently shameful. It's just that, in baking our enemies into pies, we run the risk of losing the moral high ground. I suddenly realised today, wrote the actor Kenneth Williams in his diary, that most times when someone is nasty to me, my immediate reaction is, when and how can I be revenged? It's incredibly primitive. There's no harm in recognising the more vindictive side of human nature, so long as we do not allow our reason to be dominated by our passion. This, it seems to me, is the greatest failing of the New Puritans. As I have noted, its high priests have perfected what has become known as cancel culture, a metaphor to describe the systematic public shaming and retribution against those who transgress their code. We have seen how a key aspect of their ideology is a rejection of reason, evidence-led analysis, and critical thinking. Little wonder, then, that the impulse to seek revenge comes naturally to those who have embraced this state of infantilism. Cancel culture typically takes the form of humiliation through online censure and direct contact with the target's employers in order to deprive them of their livelihoods. Through social media, irreparable reputational damage can be inflicted, even when there is no secure evidence for the accusations. Not only can this result in dismissal, but it can also impede future employment prospects. Often, the reactions are immensely disproportionate to the supposed slight, and the intentions of the transgressor are disregarded as irrelevant, much like Solzhenitsyn's account of the deaf and dumb carpenter who received a 10-year prison sentence for counter-revolutionary activity after hanging his jacket and cap on a bust of Lenin. Inevitably, practitioners of cancel culture often deny that it exists or attempt to sidestep their culpability by redefining the terms. The denial is an extension of the strategy because it enables them to continue with impunity. So acts of public shaming are reframed as holding the powerful to account, even though the vast majority of those affected are neither wealthy nor famous. When a supermarket employee loses his job for a joke he posted on Facebook, it doesn't feel much like a valiant blow against plutocracy and the ruling class. Criticism of powerful figures is not only acceptable, it is necessary. But retributive and performative mass denunciations in order to destroy lives and enforce conformity are quite another matter. A common tactic of denialism is to highlight the ongoing success of J.K. Rowling, in spite of attempts to see her cancelled. As an author whose novels have sold at least 500 million copies worldwide and grossed £6 billion, Rowling cannot be cancelled, and so the smear campaigns against her have had limited efficacy. Those who are too famous, wealthy, or powerful to be cancelled can fall prey to what the novelist and lawyer Helen Dale has called the silo effect. With continual smearing, public figures come to be associated with certain political or ideological tribes, irrespective of their actual views. This is largely caused by the escalating partisanship of news media and the online echo chamber effect. As Dale explains, both social media, by dint of algorithms, and now conventional media, by dint of deliberate hiring and firing, are herding their viewers and readers into ideological silos. Once there, they're unlikely to encounter anything other than intellectual comfort food with which they already agree. Those denialists who cite the example of Rowling to support their view that cancel culture is a myth neglect to mention the many women of lesser means who have suffered the loss of their livelihoods or had their reputations trashed for expressing similar views. Unlike Rowling, they have neither the finances nor the influence to shield themselves from the depredations of the online mob. A notable example is the children's author Gillian Philip, whose support of Rowling resulted in her being dropped by her publisher. She has since retrained as a trucker, and has written that the haulage industry is far more supportive and inclusive, and a lot less misogynistic, than the world of children's writing. The experience of German textile artist Jess de Waals offers another case in point. For many years, she subsidised her creative endeavours by working as a hairdresser in a salon based in the Soho Theatre in London. In 2019, she wrote a blog in which she explained why she did not countenance gender identity ideology. That is to say, although she affirms anyone's right to identify however they choose, she believes that the reality of biological sex cannot be gainsaid and is crucial when it comes to upholding the rights of women. She was subsequently driven out of the Soho Theatre and, after just 8 complaints, had her embroidery work removed from sale at the gift shop of the Royal Academy of Arts. Although this decision was later reversed and an apology issued, by that point, de Waals had been bombarded on social media with vitriolic messages and calls for her to commit suicide. "It's horrible," she said in an interview. "It's really difficult for people to understand what this feels like who hasn't had it. There's nothing comparable in real life." According to the New Statesman, the charge was led by fellow artists who launched petitions that resulted in cancelled exhibitions and collaborations. Often the most venomous campaigns are directed not at political opponents, but at those within the group who have deviated from the tribal covenant. This was certainly the case with Vanity Von Glow, a drag queen played by Tom Glow, who was banned from multiple cabaret venues in London for appearing at the Day for Freedom in May 2018. This free speech rally had been co-organised by Tommy Robinson, former head of the English Defence League, and because of this connection was inaccurately branded a far-right rally by many in the mainstream media. The article covering the event on the Guardian website originally bore the headline, "Thousands of far-right protesters march in London in support of free speech." This was later amended to, "Thousands march in free speech protest led by right-wing figures." But this instinct to smear an entire crowd on the basis of a minority contingent is telling. As a lifelong Labour voter, Von Glow's appearance offered a welcome counterweight to the right-leaning tendencies of the majority of the speakers. The crowd represented a diverse range of views, which would have been better served by a more eclectic lineup. As it was, Von Glow was stigmatised for sharing a stage with those of an opposing political outlook. "People couldn't conceive that there could be a reason for attending unless I agreed with everyone," Von Glow later explained to me. "Does shaking someone's hand mean you are now polluted with the toxins of their ideology?" Yet this fallacy of guilt by association was precisely the justification offered by those venues who sought to deprive Von Glow of an income. One cabaret venue known as Her Upstairs claimed that her alignment with such an event calls into question her motives and duly cancelled all future performances. For a supposedly mythological phenomenon, cancel culture has nonetheless managed to build up an impressive list of casualties. An early example was the Nobel Prize-winning biochemist Tim Hunt, who in June 2015 was ousted from his honorary position at University College London after jokes he made at a conference in Seoul were misrepresented by a journalist. In August 2019, the schoolteacher Christian Webb was fired after it was discovered that he had produced a number of comedy rap videos over a decade earlier as his alter ego MC Devo. In spite of the overtly comedic nature of these performances, their supposedly offensive nature made this a serious safeguarding issue, according to one parent at the school. In June 2020, Nick Buckley was ousted from the Mancunian Way, a charity he had set up to help the homeless and disaffected young people, after he criticised some of the more controversial aims of the Black Lives Matter organisation. In June 2021, the cricketer Ollie Robinson was banned from playing for 8 months due to offensive tweets he posted as a teenager. In addition to the ban from the Cricket Discipline Commission, he was fined £3,200 and was compelled to participate in anti-discrimination training. In June 2021, it was reported that law student Lisa Keogh had been investigated by authorities at Abertay University in Scotland for saying that women have vaginas. Although she was cleared, she described the 2-month investigation as needlessly cruel, given that it coincided with her final examination period. When it comes to cancel culture, the process is the punishment. Such examples of cancel culture in action are endless, making the widespread denialism all the more exasperating. Such stories, however, are just the barest glimpse of a much wider problem. Cancel culture works preemptively by fostering a climate in which most people are wary of speaking their minds for fear of misrepresentation, willful or otherwise. In the past, when someone misspoke at work or unintentionally caused offence, a colleague might have spoken privately to the individual concerned to resolve the issue. Nowadays, there is a tendency to shame the transgressor on social media, perhaps with a screenshot of an offending email, in order to initiate a pile-on. This is precisely what happened to William Sitwell, who resigned from his post as editor of Waitrose Food magazine after a joke he made in a private email was posted online. This kind of incident is now sadly familiar. There can be few of us who do not know people who have lost work, been disciplined, or have been passed over for promotion on the grounds of relatively innocuous remarks they have made in a private capacity. Even towards the end of my former career as a teacher, many of my colleagues had given up on making jokes in the classroom because they understood that deliberate misconstructions of their words could be used against them by pupils or parents with a personal grudge. The result was an enervated and less stimulating learning environment, and all it took was a few unscrupulous pupils to make disingenuous complaints to ruin it for the rest of them. The problem is not so much those activists who make their demands, but the tendency of employers to capitulate. Of course, this testifies to the degree of power that the New Puritans now wield as a consequence of their intimidatory gambits, but it is dispiriting to see so many in authority truckle to their bidding. Self-censorship is now an accepted feature of most modern workplaces. A national survey by the Cato Institute in 2020 found that 62% of Americans say the political climate these days prevents them from saying things they believe because others might find them offensive. When people are expected to behave like automata, who will never misspeak or inadvertently cause offence, the business of living is reduced to drudgery. Cancel culture, then, is often a form of vengeance against those who have dared to stray from the permitted ideological pathway. It depends upon the dehumanisation of the victim, because in most of these cases, basic empathy would give its practitioners pause for thought. In other words, a person selected for cancellation must first be monstered to justify the slaying. It is a malicious and inhumane trend that perversely elevates the instinct for vengeance above the virtues of forgiveness and compassion. As Solzhenitsyn reminds us, ideology blinds good people to the evil that they commit. Those examples that make the headlines are often widely discussed, precisely because so many people recognise that cancellation could happen to any of us at any time. We need to challenge this atmosphere of conformity by reasserting the values of empathy and resisting unreasonable demands for moral infallibility. There is nothing healthy about a society that no longer believes in redemption, in which a substantial proportion of the population choose to silence themselves rather than risk facing reprisals for the crime of thinking freely. Perhaps more troublingly, those who fail to conform can be entirely misrepresented in order to justify their cancellation. The example of J.K. Rowling is particularly germane. How is it that a much-loved public figure could be demonised by activists to such an extent that even those who stand apart from the culture wars have been tricked into accepting the mischaracterisation? During an appearance on Sky News in August 2020, I defended Rowling against accusations of transphobia. To be fair, the presenter responded, she has really upset a lot of transgender people in this country who feel absolutely undermined by what she said. But is this accurate, or has the furore on social media from a minority of activists generated a false impression of widespread outrage? There is a clear disconnect between what Rowling has actually said and what she is deemed to have said in the alternative reality seen through the lens of critical social justice. In other words, The truth is immaterial. What matters is the illusion to which we are expected to accede. While online activists were busy behaving like Abigail Williams and her fellow fantasists from The Crucible, embellishing each other's imagined grievances in ever more sensational ways, it was remarkable that the mainstream media had assumed that there was any substance behind the group hallucination. The more extreme culture warriors are harmless enough if ignored, but when their chicanery is taken as gospel, we are on treacherous ground. This proposed alternative reality, in which we are expected to say things we know not to be true, and to condemn systems of oppression that are supposedly invisible to anyone with privilege, is a form of chaos. We have already seen how these ideas developed over many decades, from the theorizing of postmodernists into a dominant religion that proselytizes by force. Those of us who are concerned about the impact of the culture wars understand that the ongoing assault on our cognitive liberties will create the conditions within which authoritarianism may thrive. Do we really want to live in a society in which truth no longer has any meaning? In which our words and ideas are provided for us by those who seek to regulate the limits of intellectual inquiry? The witch hunt. The Rowling case merits further scrutiny, as it seems to exemplify so many of the problems I have been describing. It all started a few years ago, when Rowling accidentally liked a contentious tweet. Soon after, she followed on Twitter the gender-critical feminist Magdalene Burns, then in the last stages of the brain cancer that took her life. This online activity was taken as evidence of Rowling's transphobia, and she was subject to attacks from activists and in the LGBT press. The major catalyst came in December 2019, after tax expert Maya Forstater lost a tribunal against her employers for wrongful dismissal. She had been fired after voicing her opposition to the government's proposed amendments to the Gender Recognition Act, which would have allowed transgender people to self-identify as the opposite sex without medical consultation. Rowling tweeted her support using the hashtag #IStandWithMaya, writing, "Dress however you please, call yourself whatever you like, sleep with any consenting adult who'll have you, live your best life in peace and security, but force women out of their jobs for stating that sex is real?" The backlash was seismic. Extreme trans activists blitzed Rowling with misogynistic abuse. She has stated that the volume of death threats has been such that she could paper the house with them. It goes without saying that this behaviour can hardly be said to be representative of the transgender community as a whole, and many decent trans people expressed dismay at the damage this was causing to public perception. The situation escalated even further when Rowling criticised an online article for its use of the phrase "people who menstruate," rather than the more obvious and certainly less cumbersome "women." The invective reached fever pitch. Some former Harry Potter fans even went so far as to burn their copies of Rowling's books. If only they had read their history, they might have thought twice about the optics of such a move. One journalist somehow reached the incredible conclusion that Rowling had been radicalised online. This alarmist phrase brings to mind all manner of transgressions. It's not as though she joined a fanatical death cult, or endorsed a national policy of eugenics, or embedded subliminal Nazi propaganda into her latest book for children. Rather, her radicalisation amounts to a belief that there are biological differences between men and women. "If sex isn't real," she tweeted, "there's no same-sex attraction. If sex isn't real, the lived reality of women globally is erased. I know and love trans people, but erasing the concept of sex removes the ability of many to meaningfully discuss their lives. It isn't hate to speak the truth." That anyone could possibly consider this a form of radicalisation speaks to the loss of critical faculties when one becomes immersed in an ideological thought process that can never yield to reason or compromise. This kind of mass moralistic outbreak is usually described as a witch hunt, a term which most obviously brings the Salem trials to mind. Although many are quick to dismiss the analogy as clichéd, it does share many of the core features of cancel culture. In the case of the campaign against Rowling, it is likely that even many of those who have actively participated will eventually agree that their responses were bewilderingly disproportionate. No rational person could honestly regard rape and death threats to be legitimate forms of criticism, but this has not prevented some from acting as apologists for inhumane behaviour. One online activist repudiated the notion that Rowling had been bludgeoned by the mob, claiming that she had merely faced swift and abundant critique. There are thumbscrews and daggers in these words. In The Coddling of the American Mind, 2018, Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt draw on the work of sociologist Emile Durkheim to explore how group identity can escalate into these kinds of mass surges of moral condemnation and demands for moral purity. In particular, they cite an essay by the sociologist Albert Bergesen, which identifies three key features common to these outbreaks. Firstly, they emerge quickly and with a sudden intensity. Secondly, the crimes of the supposed perpetrators are seen to threaten the collective, the nation, the people, the revolution, or the state. Finally, the charges are often based on minor or seemingly insignificant acts. All of these features apply to the Rowling case. Having spoken to a number of people who consider Rowling to be transphobic, I have been struck by the lack of substance upon which they have based their conclusions. Either they attribute opinions to her that she does not believe, quote phrases out of context in order to skew their meaning, or attempt a form of guilt by association. For example, her liking of a tweet posted by an individual who elsewhere might have expressed hostility towards trans people is taken as evidence that Rowling herself shares such hostility, as though agreeing with an individual on any given point suggests an endorsement of everything he or she has ever said. One apparently damning moment was when Rowling posted an image of a t-shirt that she had bought from Wild Women Workshop, along with a link to the shop's website. Pink News described the online store as a hotbed of anti-trans messaging and merchandise, citing badges and stickers bearing phrases such as "fuck your pronouns," "lesbians don't have penises," and "trans ideology erases women." Leaving aside the dubious claim that such sentiments are actually transphobic, these were not the items that Rowling had promoted. Under the circumstances, it is to be expected that she would feel a certain affinity for the slogan on this particular t-shirt, "This witch doesn't burn." This is what Bergesen meant when he wrote of the crimes and deviations in witch hunts that seem to involve the most petty and insignificant behavioural acts. For those of us not caught up in the anti-Rowling hysteria, it seems incomprehensible that liking certain tweets or wearing a t-shirt could warrant such an aggressive reaction. Perhaps most egregious of all was the slew of negative press following Rowling's detective novel Troubled Blood, 2020, written under the pseudonym Robert Galbraith. In his review for The Telegraph, Jake Kerridge made reference to the likelihood that Rowling's decision to include a killer who, at one point, disguises himself in a woman's coat was likely to stir ire in some quarters. One wonders what critics of Rowling's stance on trans issues will make of a book whose moral seems to be "never trust a man in a dress." Kerridge's view that this is the book's moral is far-fetched, and in predicting the outcry in this manner, he inadvertently provoked it. Again, it was the Pink News whose coverage was the most fear-mongering. J.K. Rowling's latest book is about a murderous cis man who dresses as a woman to kill his victims, bawled the headline. Most of us were left bemused as to how a line taken out of context from a review could be used to justify the escalation of a campaign to demonise an author on increasingly spurious grounds. Again, we see that reality was being subordinated to the lived experience of activists who had simply decided that a book they had not read was a transphobic call to arms. In order to placate her critics, Rowling issued a measured and compassionate statement on her website to outline her thought process surrounding this apparently most controversial of topics. She explained that her experiences as a victim of domestic abuse had led to her interest in trans issues and the concerns that feminists have raised about the threat to single-sex spaces that may result from gender self-identification. Those who read Rowling's statement with an open mind could not possibly infer that she felt any hatred or prejudice towards trans people, and yet this is the astonishing conclusion that many subsequently reached. The Weald Community School in West Sussex imbibed this moonshine when its governors decided to drop Rowling's name from one of their houses. A year later, the Holy Trinity Church of England Primary School in Richmond followed suit. One would have thought that a woman who reignited children's literature for a generation would be worthy of a house name. But these school authorities have clearly strayed into the alternative domain of the counter-enlightenment, or, at the very least, understood that to protect themselves they should don the necessary disguise. It has hardly helped that the stars of the Harry Potter films, Daniel Radcliffe, Emma Watson, and Rupert Grint, have all explicitly opposed Rowling's views in the midst of the controversy. Leaving aside the ingratitude of three actors whose fame rests largely on their incredibly good fortune to have been cast in Rowling's films as children, there is also the problem of the unexamined mantra they all felt duty-bound to intone: trans women are women, trans men are men. Rowling's courage in the face of such an onslaught has been remarkable. Anyone who has ever been the subject of a social media frenzy will appreciate how psychologically damaging it can be, and for a figure as famous as Rowling, the extent of it is unfathomable. The intensity of the rage can be partly explained by the fact that the New Puritans have grown accustomed to getting their own way. They appear not to comprehend the idea that one of their victims might refuse to apologise, to yield to their superior authority, or retreat entirely from public life. Rowling made this point in a tweet highlighting the kind of threat she regularly receives online, this time an activist wishing her a very nice pipe bomb in the mailbox. "To be fair," she replied, "when you can't get a woman sacked, arrested, or dropped by her publisher, and cancelling her only made her book sales go up, there's really only one place to go." Many other celebrities are in lockstep over this issue. The actor George Takei offered a representative example when he tweeted, "When you defend so-called biological sex, you sound scientifically ignorant and you elevate transphobia." But biology is not something that can be simply abandoned at will, and Takei's claims would see him fail the most rudimentary of courses in human anatomy. As the trans writer and YouTuber Blair White has pointed out, most of those who have supported Rowling are themselves trans, while many of the more vociferous attacks have come from self-declared trans allies, such as Takei, who are speaking on behalf of others. She notes that the vast majority of trans individuals accept that sex differences are innate and immutable. "Biological sex exists," she writes. "Without it, there is no such thing as being trans." Too often, activists are advancing an absolutist worldview, which is unsustainable when set against the experiential reality of the vast majority of people. They are, as Kathleen Stock has put it, immersed in a fiction. In spite of their determination, this is not an argument that they can win. As the author and critic Leslie Stephen noted in Hours in a Library, 1892, "Facts revenge themselves upon the man who denies their existence." In the ongoing cultural battle between those who value liberal principles and those who favour the intolerance of ideological cliques, Rowling's refusal to kowtow to voguish groupthink is a promising sign that all is not lost. There is always value in telling the truth in the face of pressure to conform. Even for those who take issue with Rowling's perspective, she surely deserves respect for her honesty in such a pyretic atmosphere. When it comes to contentious issues, we need more conversation, not less. This can never happen while the New Puritans are blurring the line between truth and illusion. Safetyism. Up until relatively recently, I led a course on stand-up for aspiring young comedians, whose sessions took place on Saturday afternoons at a theatre in central London. It was a forum in which the group's members could develop new material, hone their performance skills, and offer each other criticism and advice. I was always pleasantly surprised by the enthusiasm of the group and the genuine desire to improve, given that I have long recognised that stand-up appears to be the favoured career path for egoists. I once shared a flat at the Edinburgh Festival with a young woman who claimed that she had no interest in comedy, but was only performing stand-up in order to become famous. One has to admire her honesty, if not her narcissism. The groups I taught at the theatre were, on the whole, not so cynical. It was enjoyable to work with talented people who cared about the craft for its own sake, some of whom went on to pursue a career in stand-up. I only ran the course for 6 years, but over that time there was an undeniable shift in how these young comics perceived their roles. Cultural developments are typically imperceptible. Yet here I could see evidence of the sea change with each term's new cohort. Discussions about limitations in comedy became increasingly fraught, with more and more participants pushing back against the notion that their peers ought to be able to joke about anything. By the end of my time at the theatre, there were members of the group who seemed intent on policing the material of others and assessing its moral quality. One even boasted about how she had taken to going to open mic nights to castigate comics who had offended her sensibilities. It was as though one of the Pharisees of the New Testament had been reincarnated in teenage form. One day, I was asked to attend a meeting to address a complaint which had been made by a member of the group. Apparently, a joke I had posted on Twitter had made her feel unsafe, and so the theatre felt they could not renew my contract. I was not too aggrieved. By this point, I had other sources of income and was only really continuing out of a sense of loyalty. Yet the idea that someone who had been appointed in his capacity as a stand-up should become unemployable for the crime of telling jokes seemed incoherent. We parted on congenial terms, but the theatre's failure to defend artistic freedom in the face of palpably disingenuous appeals to safety was certainly disappointing. Claiming to feel unsafe when faced with an alternative worldview has become a grimly predictable strategy of the New Puritans. In September 2018, activist Dr. Adrian Harrop appeared on Sky News and claimed that a poster which quoted the dictionary definition of woman made trans people feel unsafe. In October 2020, students at Cambridge University mobilised to have a porter at Clare College sacked because he had resigned from his seat on the City Council in opposition to a motion relating to trans rights. Their assertion that he made them feel unsafe is in keeping with an ideology that sees words as little grenades primed to explode. More recently, students at Wolfson College said they were made to feel unsafe due to a photographer's words at a matriculation ceremony. As students attempted to dismount from a raised platform, the photographer said, "For any women that are having any problems, there are a couple of gentlemen that are here to help you." One can only guess at the scenes of panic and horror that ensued. It certainly doesn't take much to breach the protocol of the New Puritanism. For a close approximation, simply imagine the Debrett's Guide to Etiquette having been rewritten by someone with a histrionic personality disorder. The inevitable letter of complaint claimed that the photographer's remark was not in keeping with the university's ethos as a safe space for people of all genders and created a targeted atmosphere of inequality. Luckily, he wasn't fired, but he was forced to make an apology. There is something unappetizing about the idea of a group of some of the most privileged young people in the country castigating a working-class individual for failing to observe their code. Little wonder that the mostly bourgeois firebrands of the culture war have earned themselves the sobriquet of crybullies. Complainants, then, are following a predetermined linguistic formula, a kind of liturgical call and response that overrides the necessity for individual thought. Reading any number of online petitions of this kind, one quickly becomes familiar with the jigsaw puzzle of pre-digested maxims out of which the prose is formed. Take, for instance, this testimony from one student who attended a Christmas dinner at South College, University of Durham, at which journalist Rod Liddell had been invited to speak. "I have not felt this unwelcome ostracized and unsafe since arriving at the university. LGBT students shouldn't be subjected to this treatment. Enabling homophobia enables hate crimes and discrimination. To see this from my college principal has sent a clear message. Durham is not a safe space for LGBT individuals such as myself. I'm furious that this was allowed to happen. If there is no apology or repercussions, I cannot see myself remaining here. This account is quoted in an open letter penned by the university's Intersectional Feminist Society, LGBT Plus Association, Labour Club and Women's, spelt WOMXN, Association, calling for an immediate apology from the event organiser and an acknowledgement from the college principals that it is inappropriate to invite harmful guests. Anyone remotely familiar with the language of the New Puritans could have pieced together this complaint in advance. Note how safety is invoked twice, not merely as a hyperbolic means to express a sense of discomfort, but to demand action. Note also the conflation of words and violence in the belief that the speaker's language equates to enabling hate and discrimination. Then, of course, there is the air of finality to the tone. There is no discussion to be had with those who have already made clear that alternative voices are not to be heard. The way in which the word safe has been weaponized is quite the irony. We are dealing here with a phenomenon that has been described by Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt as safetyism, a culture that appears to be particularly common in higher education. When activists called for the removal of the statue of colonialist Cecil Rhodes at Oriel College, Oxford, part of the strategy was to insist that it was a form of violence to expect black students to walk in its vicinity. The statue remains in place because the university authorities had the courage not to defer to this kind of entitlement. The same cannot be said for the plaques commemorating the visit of King Leopold II of Belgium to Queen Mary University in London, which were removed because of his tyrannical reign in the Congo after a student outcry arose about 130 years too late. It should go without saying that nobody's safety is threatened by atrocities committed by long-dead historical figures. The language of physical harm is a rhetorical device intended to strengthen the case for ideological submission. More generally, the lexicon of critical social justice reduces individuals to their corporeal substance. We hear this in phrases such as female bodies, black bodies, or queer bodies, a strangely dehumanising choice of words. Similarly, those who challenge the content of LGBT sex education at schools are accused of erasing gay people and somehow denying their very existence. Even the phrase brothers and sisters can be reframed as genocidal. As one activist put it, when you say brothers and sisters, you're erasing non-binary, two-spirit and gender-expansive trans folks who live beyond the binary. Constantly being erased is exhausting. Many are now asking whether such assertions can possibly persist in the wake of a global pandemic, when one would have thought that the notion of safety could be at least temporarily restored to its original definition. But this is to assume that the conflation of words and violence is anything other than strategic. As the sociologist Frank Ferretti has noted, there is a performative dimension to the declaration that one feels unsafe. Employers are unlikely to discipline workers over a simple difference of opinion, but once an allegation is made that personal safety has been jeopardised, they are obliged to take action. The same principle is true of school and university authorities. One of the most overt instances of the strategic deployment of the rhetoric of safety was the furore at Batley Grammar School in West Yorkshire in March 2021. A teacher who had shown a caricature of the Prophet Muhammad during a lesson was suspended for causing offence and soon after went into hiding following death threats. Protesters gathered outside the school and stated that they would not disperse until he was sacked. Given that blasphemy laws no longer exist in the United Kingdom, these protesters inevitably couch their complaints in terms of safety and well-being. One protester, arrogantly claiming to speak on behalf of the Muslim community, read out a statement in which the school authorities were accused of failing in their duty of safeguarding, and the teacher himself was charged with threatening and provocative behaviour. The Muslim Council of Britain resorted to similar tactics, suggesting that the teacher created a hostile atmosphere. As much as I prefer to take people at their word, it seems unlikely that any of those objecting seriously believed that the children's safety had been compromised by a religious studies lesson about free speech. Certainly the pupils did not appear to agree with those who were speaking on their behalf, which is why some of them created an online petition to have their teacher reinstated. Despite all their talk of safeguarding, the protesters seem to be oblivious to a far more dangerous trend, that as a result of the various Islamist terrorist attacks in France in recent years, from the massacre at the offices of the French magazine Charlie Hebdo in January 2015, to the beheading of schoolteacher Samuel Paty in October 2020, the right to criticise and ridicule religion has been increasingly under threat. There has never been a more pressing time to engage with these issues in the classroom. Yet such discussions become impossible if activists are insistent that to even broach the subject is to jeopardise their safety. That this tactic has been successful is clear from the Nexus database of news publications, which, as Ferretti has noted, reveals that the phrase "feel unsafe" has risen exponentially over the past 40 years. The accusation was levelled at Neil Thin, a senior lecturer in social anthropology at the University of Edinburgh, who subsequently faced a two-month investigation. The complaints began after Thin had criticised the Resisting Whiteness conference for offering racially segregated spaces in September 2019. A year later, the David Hume Tower, named after one of the key philosophers of the Enlightenment, was renamed as 40 George Square, on the grounds that Hume had written passages in an essay in 1753 that would be deemed discriminatory by today's standards. Although the blandness of the new name certainly felt appropriate, given the architecture of the building itself, it was a gesture that was doubtless rushed through, without sufficient consultation, as a means to appease protesters. For raising objections to the conference and the new name of the David Hume Tower, Thin was accused of racism and, bizarrely, rape apologism. To give a sense of the Olympic stupidity of his detractors, one need only consider that his remark that civilization is for everyone was presented as Exhibit A. A similar fate befell the former rector of Edinburgh University, Anne Henderson, who was falsely smeared by activists as transphobic and anti-Semitic and not fit to hold office, simply for tweeting about a meeting at the House of Commons on the proposed reforms to the Gender Recognition Act. This vicious campaign was doubtless exacerbated by the university's failure to tackle her abusers. When Henderson suggested that those making false allegations ought to be held to account, the university principal told her that it would only make matters worse. The bullies, in other words, had been given carte blanche to torment their victim without fear of repercussions. As Solzhenitsyn noted, unlimited power in the hands of limited people always leads to cruelty. I have argued that the claim of victimhood as a means to bludgeon others is a hallmark of the New Puritans. When Selina Todd, a history professor at the University of Oxford, was assigned security guards in order to attend lectures, is it feasible to suggest that those who felt unsafe as a result of her views on feminism were the real victims here? Similarly, after philosophy professor Kathleen Stock resigned from the University of Sussex, following a campaign of abuse and harassment from student activists who claimed that her very presence excludes and endangers trans people, there can be few left in any doubt as to which party qualifies as the aggressor. And what of Joe Phoenix, a criminology professor who was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder after a similarly vitriolic campaign while she was working at the Open University? That such activists have been so indulged for so long should be a grave cause for concern. The vice principal of Edinburgh University, Sarah Smith, has recently drawn attention to this trend, admitting that students increasingly want to challenge what is taught and how it is taught. This is not a sustainable situation, and explains why institutions committed to freedom of inquiry and speech, such as Rolleston College in Savannah and the University of Texas at Austin, have recently been established. While the older institutions allow themselves to depreciate further under the influence of critical social justice, these new institutions hope to defy this regressive craze. Who would ever have thought that some of our most prestigious seats of learning would be reduced to that image from Shakespeare's Measure for Measure, where the baby beats the nurse and quite athwart goes all decorum? The Purge. In early 897, Pope Stephen VI had the body of his predecessor Formosus exhumed, dressed in its priestly attire, and propped up in the council chamber to face trial for trumped-up charges of perjury and usurping the bishopric of Rome. During what came to be known as the Synodus Horrenda, Cadaver Synod, Stephen hurled abuse at the corpse and tauntingly challenged it to reply to his accusations. When he was inevitably found guilty, Formosus was stripped, mutilated, and thrown to mobs who obligingly consigned him to the River Tiber. Not content with denouncing the living, the new Puritans have perfected a form of cancel culture that, like this maniacal pontiff, seeks to condemn the dead. In February 2019, an interview with screen legend John Wayne for Playboy magazine resurfaced when screenwriter Matt Williams posted screenshots on Twitter. The outrage was mostly confined to social media, until mainstream publications such as The Independent deemed it to be newsworthy. 8 months later, students at the University of Southern California, Wayne's alma mater, were demanding that an exhibit in his honour be removed. Such incidents are now typical. In January 2018, the poet Liz Lochhead proclaimed that Scottish literary icon Robert Burns was a sex pest, citing a private letter in which he had boasted of his sexual encounters with his lover, Jean R. Moore, by saying he had fucked her until she rejoiced. In July 2018, a group of students at Manchester University covered up a mural in the Union Building, which included the text of Rudyard Kipling's poem, If. The student diversity officer pointed out that Kipling held views about ethnic minorities which are not in line with 21st century values. In June 2021, English Heritage condemned the children's author Enid Blyton for being racist and xenophobic, and updated its website accordingly. In September 2021, academics appointed as part of the Globe Theatre's anti-racist programme decried The Tempest for Shakespeare's violent colonial ideas and claimed that the play could cause harm to modern audiences. There is nothing new about any of this. Every generation produces those who insist on digging up the corpses of the past and putting them on trial, and they've always seemed faintly ridiculous. The online video of plummy-voiced activists barging into a Winston Churchill-themed cafe in North London to protest against colonialism went viral, not because of a mass surge of approval for their cause, but because the spectacle was inherently funny. They are Malvolio reborn, the puritanical archetype that recurs with each successive moral panic. And just like Shakespeare's cross-gartered loon, their bloated sense of self-importance and need to enforce moral standards makes them a perennial target for satirists and comedians. In the 1960s, such figures drew the ire of playwright Joe Orton, whose farces brutally mocked the pomposity and hypocrisy of the establishment. In Loot, 1965, the character of Fay solemnly places a copy of the Ten Commandments on the casket of the dead Mrs. McCleavy and says, "The Ten Commandments. She was a great believer in some of them." Anything that contradicts the alternative reality of the counter-enlightenment faces the possibility of being purged. In 2020, the new Puritans took to the streets in the form of mobs who toppled statues of historical figures if they were deemed to be problematic. Academic allies were posting advice on how safely to pull down monuments. After the Lincoln Memorial had been vandalized in Washington, Sarah Parsak, a professor of Egyptology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, tweeted instructions on how to demolish obelisks, implying strongly that the Washington Monument ought to be next. Madeline O'Dent, curator of the Royston Museum in Hertfordshire, singled out the statue of Winston Churchill in Parliament Square as a potential target, suggesting certain corrosive chemicals that were easy to obtain and could cause permanent damage. More recently, a golden coach used to transport the Dutch royal family on ceremonial outings has come under fire because of an illustration of slaves on one of its panels. That it was built in the late 1800s is considered irrelevant. One of the activists said they should chop it up and burn it. As expected, the threshold for what constitutes unacceptable behaviour, even from long-dead historical figures, has begun to spread. There have been calls in the English town of Poole to remove the statue of the founder of the Boy Scout movement, Robert Baden-Powell, in spite of leading historians pointing out that the allegations of his Nazi sympathies are unfounded. While in Leicester, there has been a petition to pull down a statue of Mahatma Gandhi, claiming that he was a fascist, racist, and sexual predator. Even a bust of the abolitionist Thomas Henry Huxley has been targeted on the grounds that he held outdated views on race. As someone who was born in 1825, it would be extremely odd if his views were not outdated. One would have thought that his campaigns against the slave trade would have been cause for leniency. Sometimes the connections are extraordinarily tenuous. The National Maritime Museum has commissioned a review into the heroic status of Lord Nelson, given that he was a leading figure in the Royal Navy. There is no firm evidence of Nelson's views on the subject of race, but it is alleged that the Navy's involvement in slave trafficking is sufficient to see him condemned. Of course, the Navy also spent a full century suppressing the Atlantic slave trade, but such details are overlooked for the sake of a more readily digestible and simplistic view of history. A particularly feeble connection was found by the curators of a recent exhibition of the 18th century satirical artist William Hogarth at Tate Britain. Various notes were added by curators to highlight the sexual violence and slavery of the works, including a comment on a self-portrait which explains that the chair upon which Hogarth is sitting would have been constructed from timber shipped from the colonies, and asks whether it could stand in for all those unnamed black and brown people, enabling the society that supports his vigorous creativity. William Gladstone, the 19th century Prime Minister, has repeatedly been made the target of activists' ire. There have been calls to remove his statue and change the name of the Gladstone Library in Harden, Wales, in spite of the fact that he bequeathed £40,000 and much of his own book collection to the institution. In the Council of Brent in London, a report was approved to consider renaming the Gladstone Park Gardens and Gladstone Park Primary School. At the University of Liverpool, a student accommodation block called Gladstone Hall was renamed after communist activist Dorothy Kuya. All of this defies reason, given that Gladstone was an outspoken critic of slavery, referring to the trade as by far the foulest crime that taints the history of mankind. He has been damned because of the sins of his father, who owned plantations in the Caribbean. Leaving aside the oddity of naming a building after Kuya, an enthusiastic ally of the Soviet regime, even after news emerged of Stalin's labour camps and the mass slavery he had reintroduced, how can it be legitimate to judge Gladstone for the behaviour of his father? I cannot help but think of the racing driver Connor Daly, who lost a sponsorship deal due to a racial slur uttered by his father before he was even born. At no point does it appear to enter the minds of these protesters that there might be other, more generous assessments of the lives and careers of these historical figures. They are convinced that Gandhi's statue remains in place in order to celebrate his most problematic aspects, rather than as a commemoration of his successful campaign of peaceful resistance to British rule in India. One suspects that their expertise on the subject is limited to a few Google searches of websites that are sympathetic to their cause. Much of this comes down to a fundamental disagreement over what purpose these monuments serve. For instance, activists have successfully petitioned to have the statue of Thomas Guy at the hospital in London that bears his name relocated to a less prominent place. The governing body has announced that a plaque will accompany the statue in its new home to offer an account of his connections to the slave trade. Few would deny that Guy's investments in the South Sea Company, a group that did transport slaves and supplied them to Spanish plantations in Central and South America, and the money he eventually made from selling his shares, enabled him to establish the hospital in 1721. But was the statue erected to celebrate his indirect involvement in slavery? Or was it rather to acknowledge the role he played in providing healthcare to the poor and destitute? If we were to apply the standard of moral purity to any figure who has been immortalized in statue form, none could remain standing. One might counter this view by arguing that slavery is an especially egregious moral evil, and that anyone involved in its perpetuation, however tangentially, should not be commemorated. How far does one take this reasoning, and how far back in time must it apply? Are we to bulldoze the Parthenon, given that slavery was a mainstay of Athenian society? Is Buckingham Palace to be demolished, given the royal family's history of involvement in colonial enterprises? As a shareholder in slaving voyages, should Queen Elizabeth I, the subject of London's oldest statue, not also be torn down? One wonders how the bronze bust of Karl Marx over his grave in Highgate Cemetery will fare, given that his political philosophy and his casual use of racial slurs makes him a potential target for both the right and the left. And where does this leave The Guardian, that propaganda wing of the identitarian movement? The publication was founded by John Edward Taylor, a man who made his fortune from the cotton trade. Its editorials openly supported the South in the American Civil War, opposed abolition, and denounced Abraham Lincoln for freeing the slaves. Should every copy be incinerated? If we tolerate iconoclastic demolition on the basis of subjective judgment, we establish a precedent that we may well live to regret. Our shared humanity will help us to find some common ground here. We all understand the strength of feeling when it comes to racism and the exploitation of our fellow human beings. White supremacy is, as Ibram X. Kendi rightly says, a nuclear ideology that poses an existential threat to human existence. To raise questions about the wisdom of permitting mobs to destroy public landmarks in no way implies any degree of approval for the crimes of the past. "How you feel about that statue is how you feel about slavery," wrote LBC radio presenter James O'Brien in relation to the toppling of the statue of Edward Colston in Bristol in June 2020. But the chances of finding anyone in the United Kingdom who would defend slavery are infinitesimal, and it's surely inconceivable that anyone making these allegations sincerely believes otherwise. This debate is not about the rights and wrongs of slavery, a matter that was settled in Western nations in the 19th century. It seems strange that the New Puritans do not focus their energies on addressing the very real problem of global slavery in the 21st century, rather than attempting to revise the inescapable facts of Britain's past. Historical artefacts are part of the cultural landscape, a reminder of a society that is long dead. They record not only the triumphs of the past, but its follies and villainies too. Good historians avoid making moral judgments, because to assess individuals from the past on the basis of whether or not they satisfy the ethical standards of today is to be guilty of presentism. If the activists currently calling for the removal of statues had been born at the height of British colonialism, they would almost certainly have endorsed slavery as well. It takes genuine free thinkers like the anti-slavery campaigners Olardo Equiano, Elizabeth Hayrick, and William Wilberforce to envisage a moral framework beyond the conventions of the day. Those with a tendency towards groupthink, such as the New Puritans, could never have conceived of a concept so radical as abolitionism. We often hear the New Puritans dismiss as clichéd the charge that they have Orwellian tendencies. But it is impossible to read of their revisionist shenanigans without being reminded of Winston Smith's words in 1984. Every record has been destroyed or falsified. Every book has been rewritten. Every picture has been repainted. Every statue and street and building has been renamed. Every date has been altered. And that process is continuing day by day and minute by minute. History has stopped. We cannot change the past, but we can learn from it. As platitudinous as this might sound, it is worth reiterating at a time when cultural revolutionaries are promoting a tunnel-visioned approach to history and the arts. An alternative reality based on a denial of the past is no kind of reality at all.